Welcome into This Has to Work. I'm Matt Hoddle, and over there is
Mickey Millsap.
And we are continuing our mini series a la NBC 1987 mini series. No, I don't know. I'm dating myself. That's how old I am. Do you remember mini series?
I do remember the mini series. Yes. I think it still exists.
Does it really?
I think so.
Huh. I think they call it something different now because that's very dated.
Gotcha.
To call it the mini series. Anyway, so we're here to talk a little bit about the Alabama Futures Fund on its one-year anniversary, and we've kind of broken down the first year into a couple different topics, and today we're going to talk about one that we get asked a lot about, which is I am a startup founder, and I am thinking about raising capital, and I'm thinking about raising capital from one of a number of different sources. So we're going to jump in to this kind of a quick fire round here and talk about this. So I'm going to ask this for Mickey. I'm going to put him on the spot. So in a kind of a quick fire fashion, like signals for readiness. And if you thought of like when you see a founder or a startup and you think they are definitely not ready to raise money, what are those signals for you?
Well, that's a pretty easy one. You know, I'm a big fan of customer discovery and the lean startup method. It's people that have a great idea. They are confident that their idea is the greatest thing in the world, and they've done absolutely no work in customer discovery to find out if they are solving a problem that anybody else cares about.
They just know that this is a great idea.
If I build it, they will come.
Or they're solving such a personal problem that it may be so personal, they're only solving it for themselves.
That's right.
Or for a very small group of people.
That's right.
So they're definitely not ready. Who else is definitely not ready? Like, what are the things you see and you go, oh, geez, don't do that yet?
Well, I think it's folks, I mean, the first problem is they go out and they build the product before they know if anybody needs it. So they've spent a ton of money building it, and then they come to you and say, well, we built it. All we need is marketing dollars now.
That's right.
We get that one all the time.
Yeah.
Well, this thing will work as long as I get money to go market. How much have you spent to build it? Oh, $100,000. Oh, my. That probably wasn't the best use of resources. I'm starting to question your judgment a little bit.
So what about the next set is like maybe ready, maybe not ready, but they're kind of right there. What are those things that you see where you're like, oh, geez, you know, you might be ready, but you want to think about this a little bit more?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I have a maybe ready. I think it's more, they don't really understand the market they're trying to go after. And I mean, some of this comes out of the customer discovery side, but they think they need to go raise money and maybe they haven't defined a big enough market. I mean, I think there is, and we're going to talk about this, I'm sure, later, a disconnect between people who think they're fundable and those that actually are. So they think they need to raise money, but they're not really a fundable type of company, if that makes sense. So they've got some customers, they're doing something, but maybe it's just not a venture funding opportunity. And I don't think they understand that necessarily.
The one that I always think about or it comes to mind almost automatically is all of my early customers are friendlies.
That's right.
They're friends, they're family, they're people I used to work with, they're people that are supporting me because it's me, not because business is something I'm actually trying to solve a problem with. That's one that we see, I think, fairly often. Or a poor understanding of how much they need to raise and why they need to raise that. I think it kind of goes back to your, well, you know, I've got this great product, now I just need to plow it into sales and marketing. And you go, well, maybe, maybe not. Let's take a look at that. But that's kind of the maybe not ready. And then when you think about somebody who is, yes, you really need to start thinking about it, you're ready to start this process and consider it, what does that look like to you?
I'm going to sound like a broken record. They've done the customer discovery. They validated the market. They have an idea of who their customer is. They can really define that. And they can tell the story about why this is going to solve a problem for that customer. And I'm amazed time and time again at founders that we talk to who spend slide after slide telling me every detail about what their product does, but don't tell me the story behind it, about why anybody cares. The ones that are ready, they understand that. They spend less time on product, and they're passionate about it. They care about it. They can show that. You'd be amazed how many founders are doing something just to do a startup. They don't really care about the problem they're solving. They need to be able to display that as well.
I always think about when I hear somebody talking about their solution in matter-of-fact terms, and it's kind of devoid of platitudes and high-minded kind of word choice. So it's, we build this, we built this, this is what it does, this is who we're working with, this is what we've learned. It's just real matter of fact. It almost feels dry. Like, I hate to say that, but it's like when the pitch is just boring, to some degree of like, this is what we've done and these are the results and there's some data behind it, then it's like, yeah, you're definitely ready to tell that story in a compelling way.
Well, and you said it right there, and I had this conversation with someone today, in fact, that it's being able to tell a story, but more specifically telling a story through data. And I am, again, amazed at how many founders aren't tracking stuff even at a very early stage, right? So the most data-oriented founders are the ones that typically when they come in are the most prepared and can tell me why this is going to be a good investment. You've got to be able to tell story through data, even if it's early rough data.
One of the things that comes up a lot when we're talking to people is maybe not a full understanding of all their funding options. They think about funding maybe in one of two ways. So if you think, and I'm oversimplifying, but let's just think about these in buckets. So you have, you know, kind of angel investing, you have kind of fund or structured fund or structured funding type opportunities. You have joint venture, corporate development. You even have, frankly, you have commercial loan opportunities, sure, right? All of those are available to people. And I don't know that they always assess those. And so just kind of quickly wanted to go through and kind of put like, you know, this versus this. And one of the ones that we come up with a lot is people not understanding the difference between kind of angel investing and structured kind of capital or fund type investing. So to be specific, what can they expect from an angel investor that may be different than if they're approaching a fund?
Yeah. So angel investing has evolved quite a bit in the last maybe 20, 25 years. The original angels out in Silicon Valley were wealthy guys that had sold or IPO'd their startup and maybe didn't have another great idea that they wanted to work on, but were really passionate about finding founders that they believed in. And so they would stroke checks to them individually and become very heavily involved with the company. Now that's adapted quite a bit. We have angel networks now where they kind of syndicate investment through a group of angels. And they can do all different stages. I mean, very early on, angel investing was kind of that initial first check, right? Today, that's different. I mean, we have an angel group here in town that does mostly Series A type stuff. So it's not necessarily about stage. They can do all stages, but angels are typically individuals, right? Hence the term angel. The institutional capital, which is what we are, which is private equity in kind of a different sense. It's, you know, venture capital is private equity. Is organized capital where we have a fund that is raised that we have to deploy over a certain period of time in a certain type of company depending on the thesis of our fund.
Yeah, and I think that's the big disconnect is, you know, an angel investor could decide on a Tuesday that they really like this SaaS company.
Right.
And then on Thursday decide that they really like what this person is doing with, you know, fair trade coffee. And those two things have nothing to do with each other. The likelihood of a fund doing both of those deals is remote because that's probably going to be, one of those is going to be outside the thesis.
It's very rare. Funds typically, especially smaller funds, typically have a very tight focus. Some of the larger funds like the Kleiner Perkins, the Benchmarks, you know, they'll have different industry groups that they focus, especially Kleiner. But yeah, an angel can really invest in whatever they want to, and it could be a $10,000 check. Be a $500,000 check, depending on their interest.
And even in those funds that are multifaceted, there is a fund manager that is working on the free trade coffee segment, right? That might fit their thesis.
That's right.
And there's a completely different fund manager probably working on the SaaS product. So even within a monster fund,
it's very specialized.
It's very specialized. And so that's important to know. The one that I think people don't necessarily think about as maybe as quickly as they should, or I don't say quickly, but as readily as they should, is this idea of this joint venture corporate development funding arm. Now, let's be clear, when you're going into that, you are finding a company, usually a large company, that's looking to innovate in a space in which you're going to play. And so by doing, you know, entering into a joint venture or entering into some sort of agreement with their corporate development, which is an investment arm, you know, strategic investment arm of that company, you're probably developing a product that either they're going to be the only customer for, or they're going to buy you out very, very early. So you're kind of capping potentially, certainly your independence, but also too kind of your flexibility on what that looks like as far as growth and scale. It doesn't always happen that way,
That's right.
A lot of times it happens that way. But we run across these really capital intensive startups that are having to recreate technologies that big companies already have. And if they were able to go into a joint venture with those big companies, they wouldn't have to spend capital on replicating what these folks have three and four times over. And so what does it look like to innovate among somebody else's resources where a fraction of that investment dollars can be stretched that much further if you were looking at it kind of within that corporate development or even joint venture space?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on it earlier in the conversation about it, that it can be really good, but it can be limiting. Like you said, it's typically, that's going to be your first customer. It's like customer concentration. They might have some say in what other customers you can go acquire that might be competition. So you can limit your upside growth with that. I do think, though, to your point, there for a lot of companies, big companies don't innovate well. And so, you know, we see it in the construction space here. There are a couple of kind of funds within some of the large construction companies that are looking for stuff that they know they can't develop in-house. It could be a really nice win. It's probably, you know, they're probably not out there investing in stuff that has unicorn potential, the billion-dollar exits, but, you know, it could be in the 10, 20, $30 million range, which for a young entrepreneur, that can be great.
Right. And there's somebody who's listening to this podcast right now who's probably screaming at their screen or into outer space saying, well, what about bootstrapping? We didn't even talk about bootstrapping. And that is an option for people. If you can figure out how to self-fund that without taking outside capital, that's always an option. You know, that's really just a calculation you're making between, do I need the capital to scale? Can I bootstrap this? Is that an acceptable trade-off for me? Can I make this, you know, make a run of this without taking outside capital? That's certainly a consideration you can make.
Well, and I'm a big fan of bootstrapping. I think you do it up until the point when it makes sense to bring capital. The first thing you're going to do is learn how to be capital efficient. That is a great trait for an entrepreneur to have. One of the things that I see kind of on the coasts, and by no means am I an expert on this, early seed stage rounds are really big now. So really early companies, pre-revenue, are raising a lot of money. What that means to me is they can kind of spin their way out of problems. They're not thinking through it. When you spend that first 6 to 12 months bootstrapping and building it and holding it together with duct tape, you learn how to be efficient with your capital and learn how to be creative. I think some of that's getting missed right now. People are so hyper-focused on scaling quickly, and there's a time for that. But I think you learn a ton bootstrapping at the beginning.
Yeah, one of the advantages, and you make a really good point, which is when you first start a company, everybody pretty much is bootstrapping.
Right.
So you come to a point probably within that 6, 12, 18-month period where you go, okay, bootstrapping is getting me this far. I can see what that trajectory looks like.
Right.
And that's either okay to continue to try to do it that way, or now is the time to really think about how does capital help me scale or grow or build or become more innovative?
Yeah, I mean, certainly once you obtain the magical product market fit that everybody's trying to go for, I mean, you know you've got something that's scalable. You want to put fuel on that fire. You want it to go. It makes sense. I'm not hitting any new ground here. The idea of rich versus king, there are those that just don't want to bring in institutional capital. They don't want to sell anything. They got to own 100% of their company. Well, that's stubborn. You can, you know, again, own 100% of something really small or 70% of something really, really big.
Yeah,
I'll take B every time.
I like the example of, do you want 100% of an extra large pizza or do you want 25% of a franchise?
That's right.
Right. So that's kind of an overly simplistic way of looking at it. But yep. So when you're assessing those options, one of the things that we talk about a lot with founders is strategic and financial, capital, right?
Yep.
So some capital, all capital is financial, right? But some capital is also strategic. And so the question becomes, as you're assessing your options, needing to think about that capital source as being purely financial, being more strategic than financial, what does that look like? Because I think that we don't always do a good job of taking a step back and going, and when I say strategic, it's to take a step back. When I say strategic, I'm talking about somebody who's like, maybe I can't give you $1 million, but I can participate in a round you're doing at $100,000, and I have 30 years of experience in the industry in which your primary customers live. And I can pick up the phone at any time and get you 5 phone calls with C-level, executives.
Yeah.
Or get you some access to something that you're going to struggle to get on your own. You really have to assess the value of that outside of the capital, right?
Yeah, you do. And every founder is a little bit different. Every company is a little bit different. There are definitely investors out there that are purely financial. There are a lot of them. They write a check. They check in at the board meeting. That's it. They don't want to get involved day to day. They're not looking to help grow the company. When it's time to IPO, they might help you with that. There are a lot of those. And for some founders, that's good. There are certain fundraising stages where that's good. I think you and I tend to try to play strategic in our approach. Not so much, you know, sometimes it's the industry that we know, but often it's just we know how to work with founders at a certain stage. So for us, it's important to find founders that want an investor, that they want involved in the company to help them grow it. That's important to us. So I think for every founder, you've got to find the investor that's the best fit for you. A lot of founders take a shotgun approach to fundraising and they just shoot their deck out to every fund possible. They don't do the homework on them. My goodness, don't do that. That's a waste of your time because fundraising is exhausting. You need to figure out the funds that are going to be the best fit for what it is you do and what you want to do with the company.
Yeah, and think about this from this from the strategic standpoint to the tactical standpoint. There are a lot of ways of assessing that fit tactically. So think about it. These funds, these investors, you know, these groups, whoever they are, what kind of check sizes do they normally write? And is that what you're looking for? Are you looking for someone to take the entire round? Are you looking for somebody to be a small part of a round? Are you going to be just asking for money that's way beyond any check or any kind of participation level that they have? You can find these things out. That is actually more available than people sometimes realize. What is their thesis? You know, not everybody does this, and I understand that. Not every fund, not every investment group puts their thesis on their website, right? We actually do. And the reason that we do is because we're trying to help people self-select into, you know, kind of a submission process of saying, yeah, this fits or this doesn't fit. Now, to Mickey's point, I get frustrated sometimes because people don't bother to do that. They don't look at the website. They don't do that self-selection. And I think they're wasting their time. And to the point made, it's you know, that's a lack of resource, right? You've just kind of wasted time there.
Yeah. And talk about you did the quickfire, a founder that's not ready. They're just, you know, shotgun blasting that out to everybody. You know, if it says in your deck you need to raise $10 million and you send that to us, you've clearly done no homework.
Right.
That tells me you're not prepared. You're not ready. I mean, obviously, we're not going to take that meeting. But, yeah, the other side of it, and this is a really tough thing. We talked in the last podcast about building an ecosystem, diversity, inclusion, and networks. Those play an important part. You're an entrepreneur. You're supposed to be creative and crafty. Don't just send out blind emails to people. Figure out a way to get a warm introduction. That's part of your job, right? Use your network. Get an intro some way so that there's a reason that I'm getting excited about taking the call, sitting down with you. I'm going to take that every single time.
Yeah. I think an indicator for fit also comes to past investments. What are they invested in the
yep.
past? That helps you to get to the... Are they going to be strategic to me? Have they seen? And it's not always just investments that worked out. I mean, sometimes it can be an investment that magnificently failed. And in that, they become strategic to help you avoid some of those same open manhole covers to avoid.
Well, and the other piece of homework you need to do, reach out to the founders of those companies and find out what it was like to work with that investor. I don't think enough founders think to do that, and founders are going to share with each other. So go find out, were they good to work with? Did they hammer you? You know, what's the relationship like, and the good and the bad? Because I think, you know, there are plenty of stories of investors behaving badly. Find the one that didn't work and see how they unwound it. See what that relationship continued. If it's good, that's probably somebody you want to work with.
So assuming that you've found some sources that you want to go and engage, you had mentioned earlier, Mickey, about the importance of the story, right? Tell me the story about this and how is it compelling? When they start thinking about story, one of the things that we often see that's missing from this is, okay, I get the story. I understand the problem you're solving. I understand the market size. I understand why I should be interested in having this conversation. But one element that seems to miss from there is, why is capital important at this point in time for this business? And why is that part of the story going forward?
Yeah, I mean, we hit on this very early on when we kind of decided our investment rubric, right? Do they understand how much money they need and what it is going to be able to do for them? Where's it going to take them, especially at a seed stage, right? We're investing at a very early, very risky stage. What are you hoping to learn? Because most of our companies don't have product market fit yet, right? They're still out there testing. If you're raising $500,000, what? Not necessarily what revenue goals, but what is it you hope to learn and know and validate at the end of that $500,000? And then how does that get you to the next $2 million that you need to raise? So many founders just pick a number out of thin air. And I understand that. I've been there. You know, oh, you want to give me $100,000? I can make that work. You want to give me $1 million? I can make that work, right? Give a founder a check. They're going to figure it out. But I love it when they actually say, no, I really think this is the number and here's why. And if they can tell that, then we can have that conversation with them of, okay, well, we see it maybe a little bit more, a little bit less. Here's why. And then, you know, we're trying to get to the right number, not just a number.
And it's interesting to me how often we've had the conversation where we've talked people out of raising more money, or we've encouraged them to think longer term based on their market or based on their idea or how long it's going to take for them to really find that product market fit. Because you can kind of sense, sometimes you can kind of sense that, you know, it's going to take longer than you think it's going to take, or you're going to stub your toe a few more times than you think. And listen, and we're still learning, you know, along the way too. I mean, that's every right. day we're finding out some of these things where it's like, well, gee, had we known, right, we would have done this differently. But there are a lot of conversations we have around that about trying to find whatever that quote right, you know, number is for that fundraise. So to try to be somewhat prescriptive, I wanted to talk about at least a summary of a quick list of kind of to-dos, like things that you do want to do. I don't want to go through the don'ts. That's, I don't think it's actually that helpful, but the do's, right? So I had scrawled this out on a piece of paper so I could try to remember them all, but like have a professional looking deck. I think that that stops more conversations faster than people really realize.
It's worth investing a little bit of money to bring a designer in to help you get that looking good. I mean, it's not the end all, but it just shows some effort.
And in that deck, don't try to create the 100% deck. And what I mean by that is that it's trying to solve for every potential question from every different angle. That's just not feasible. And what you end up with is you end up with a deck that's 45 slides long and an investor that tuned you out after slide 8, right? You know, the best decks tend to be the tightest, right? They're 12 slides all in, right, with your contact and the title slide that included in those 12 slides. So that's one thing. Doing, we talked about this extensively, but I'm going to say it again. Do your homework on the investors. Don't go and solicit a meeting from somebody whose fund has absolutely nothing to do or no track record with anything that you're talking about. And if you don't know, then ask first before a pitch meeting. Ask for a meeting just to hear more about the firm or the fund or the investor. And say, I want to get a feeling for what it is that you're interested in, what you're like, you know, what you're investing in, what is exciting to you, what are you looking for in the future? You know, take a step back and maybe have that meeting first. I would say pack your humility and your conviction. It's a balance, right? People are going to call your baby ugly. There are going to be a lot of no's in this process. You know, Mickey was just sharing a story, I guess it was about a week ago, you were in Austin, and talking to a funder, or excuse me, to a startup, who went out and was looking for funding and said he pitched it 40 times. I mean, my good friend, Philip Bogdanovich at CypherSkin, you know, he's like, I've done this 100 times. And on the 101st one, I finally got a yes from an investor that I could work for. So you have to have that conviction, but you also have that humility for people to say no, or have you thought about, and really try to synthesize that information. Lauren Sturdivant at K-Status, you know, was recently on a panel, and she said, to the audience out there, for any of the founders that were out there, said, you know, take that feedback and actually do something with it. Don't just receive it graciously, but actually really do something with it. And then the last thing that I was going to ask you about is what are we missing in that list?
Yeah, I wanted to add a couple of things to that. First, the idea of the small deck, the very lean deck that tells the story, is important. It's very important, though, not to forget you're going to get asked a ton of questions. Be prepared. Anticipate what those objections are going to be from funders. For us, when I started my first company, we did business plan competitions. Great way for us to get out into a safe space and hear every question possible. So we were prepared for it. And I find a lot of folks don't do that. The second is be open to coaching in a meeting. Investors are asking questions to see if they can get under your skin a lot of the time to see how you react. How you react is going to play a big role in what they decide to do. So understand that they may be trying to push your buttons somewhat like in an interview on purpose. I think those are kind of the two big ones I would add.
The other one too is that, to kind of pull on that thread for a second, is, you know, you have these investors often that will flat out behave poorly,
yes.
Right? I'm not making excuses for them. It just
right.
happens. And so you have to take that in stride as part of how you react to that.
Yeah, the last one I wanted to add is don't get upset if they say no. To Matt's point, you know, we the founder I talked to 44 times until they got funded. There are a myriad of reasons that an investor or a fund says no to you that may have nothing to do with you. They love you. They love your idea. It doesn't fit with what they're trying to do exactly. That's something I didn't learn until I came over on this side. There's a lot of stuff that I really, really like. I can't make it fit into what we're trying to do. And, you know, we just can't fund it. So don't take that personally.
Yeah, there's 100 reasons why we have to say no. There may only be 3 reasons we can say yes.
That's right.
And that is the ratio, I think, for a lot of investors, probably most investors. So yep. That segues nicely into the last thing I want to leave on this podcast. But talking about, you know, getting ready, right? Getting ready for this. We've talked about what you actually do. But for those that haven't gotten to the point of really contemplating this, I want to reiterate the story around U-Ship and Mickey and his co-founders' development around U-Ship and being part of these business plan competitions, and then Mickey and I, you know, judging some of these locally and otherwise, and looking at these from a distance. I watch these teams get so much better having gone through these competitions, and just if nothing else, it's the repetition or it's the I'm not going to get a question I haven't already heard or heard some variation of. None of this is going to feel new to me. I'm going to have a really good, meaningful, credible answer to that simply because I've done this a bunch of times.
Yeah, I mean, you know how I feel. I'm a big believer in non-dilutive capital. Anytime you can bring money in that doesn't impact your cap table, which a lot of these competitions are, find the good ones, find ones with good judges, get to know the judges as best you can. Take their feedback, build relationships with them. We did that early on, and that was absolutely one of the most valuable things that we did. And it eventually ended up leading to us getting our first term sheet. We didn't end up working with that firm, but it was a judge in one of the competitions. So, yeah, I think, you know, early on, it's a way in a very safe space to battle test yourself, you know, figure out what people's objections are going to be and what the blind spots you have to the business are. It's a great way to do that.
Mentorship is usually free. And is really effective if you can find the right mentors to help you along the way as part of that getting ready. So competitions, mentorship, and then at the end of the day, if you have done your customer validation work, if you have really spent time understanding the customers and trying to assess at least early, conceptually, product market fit, and you have data to share with that, that is probably one of the most powerful ways to get ready for fundraising. And even if you don't ever use that to fundraise, that data is going to be important in how you grow and scale and make decisions strategically and tactically within your business. So if you're going to spend time doing something, make sure you're spending time on that, getting ready for fundraising or just getting ready to run a better business, a scalable business.
Indeed.
Very good. Well, that's all we have for this episode of This Has to Work. I've been Matt. That's been Mickey. Thanks very much for listening.